Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. From the Vasubha Theragata, first one kills the self, then one kills others, using the well-destroyed self like one who kills birds, using a dead bird as a decoy. Tea. I thought that's from Ajahn Sujato's little translation, and I just happened to be reading that at tea time a few minutes ago. I thought, wow, that's really cool. And that's going to be the subject of this Dharma talk. First, one kills the self. And I think you all understand, I hope, what that means is one uncovers this myth of a person inside who is behind all of your will, the person who chooses and does stuff. You uncover the myth of a person who is behind the knowing, the knower, the mind, the consciousness, in whatever form you have it. So to be able to uncover that illusion, delusion, whatever you wish to call it, of a self, an atta, a me, a mine, as we were just chanting in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, to do that first of all. And then you teach others. So you teach others, and that's how you kill other people's selves. You are a serial killer of selves, by which I mean, it's a beautiful metaphor, of taking away people's illusions, undermining them little by little, to take them closer and closer to the realization there's no self, no being in here, no sort of permanent essence, nothing which is behind all of this doing and knowing and sensing stuff. And then it is how that works. It's just like a person who is well destroyed self, a person who is a teacher who has, in that sense, well destroyed self, their ego, their conceit, their sense of being is totally destroyed. That does act like a lure, like a decoy, which pulls other people towards this understanding of non-self. It almost means, and I think it's quite true that this is said in the suttas, you do need someone who has killed themselves, in that sense, to lure and bring other people to that same realization. Seems that that is this beautiful path of Buddhism. You cannot penetrate that delusion which has been in the human mind for many, many lifetimes without the help of somebody else who has seen through the illusion of a self. And they do act like a lure, like a dead bird which brings other birds close to it. Just the sense of freedom, the peace, the joy, the bliss, the ease which a person who has overcome the sense of self can exhibit will bring and inspire other people to try and do the same. So that's a very, very beautiful little simile of the meaning of life. First, to uncover this illusion so your own sense of self, identity, an ego, a being, a me, a mine, a person, whatever you wish to call it, an essence, all of that is actually seen for what it really is, which is nothing there at all. And of course, it's always fascinating for many people who have really gone in to study the words of the Buddha, just how often that truth is repeated, and how many, many times in so many different ways someone like the Buddha explains there is no person, no being in there. There's nothing beyond those five khandhas. What I've started to mess around with translation, instead of calling them the five groups, call them the five components of existence. Components of existence, you look at all of those and you can't find anything solid in there to make a sense of me out of. And that's so consistent throughout all of the teachings of the Buddha, but still that's not enough for a person to actually to overcome a very deeply ingrained way of looking at the world. This is really all these are, the different ways of looking at this world, different perspectives. It is almost, you might say, just a totally different world. Just like people of different cultures see things in totally different ways. And of course, it's very difficult for us who are born in one culture to really appreciate another indigenous culture. And sometimes when you mention indigenous cultures, you know, you forget to think that there's so many indigenous cultures around this world. And the one which I often refer to was the one in northeast Thailand, which was indigenous. It had not been affected in any which way by Western civilization. I mentioned that I was sometimes in two or three villages, I was the first Westerner they'd ever seen, let alone a white monk, just a white man, the first one they'd ever seen. And I remember very clearly, with sort of a lot of joy and a lot of fun too, that these villagers in far northeast of Thailand, a remote part of the northeast of Thailand, when I went on alms round, and because that I just arrived in the monastery the afternoon before, and they hadn't even known I was there, so you just arrived on alms round early in the morning, they expected northeast Thai monks, and there this weird person arrived, white skin. And you notice how people put food in your bowl? They are supposed to be paying attention to where they're putting the food. But on this morning, they could not resist by looking at me, which meant that when they dropped the little balls of sticky rice, they fell way outside my bowl onto the floor, so I never got much rice that day. They were just so, so amazed to see something like that. But one of the things of being put in a position as a monk and expected to be part of that culture, you were not like some anthropologist who was always regarded as an outsider. The very role of being a Buddhist monk in that society, you had your place, you were a very highly respected place, you were part of the community, you were never ever regarded as an outsider. So you did see a different part, way of looking at things from the inside. It was learning a different worldview. Many, many interesting examples. One example which I like to mention was, there was a time I remember just when, I think the big road had not yet been built, but still there was these buses tearing down this dirt track. And when people in those parts of the world had parties, I mean, they really had no restraint when they're having a party. So there's a bus going on the correct side of the road. It was going fast, but within the speed limit. And then the opposite side of the road, on the wrong side of the road, one of the villagers was totally drunk, on his bicycle, on the wrong side of the road, no headlights. And of course he got creamed by the bus. But in the way of looking at it in that culture, the bus driver was at fault. He was to blame, which is why the bus driver got out of the cab and ran away and just disappeared quickly, because he would be put in jail for that, simply because just the way of looking at it, a totally different way, was, well, if you're driving the bigger vehicle, you have to look out for the smaller vehicles. And that's just the law. It doesn't matter if the smaller vehicle's doing something wrong, you've got the big vehicle, you've got to take account of that. So it's just getting you, sometimes I said, you can't, that's not right. It is right, seeing things in a different world view. And there's so many different world views which you can actually look at things with. And we've got stuck in the world view of always looking at things, at life, from the sense of me, the sense of self, that I am the one who's in charge. I am the one who is listening to this talk. I am the one who, if you want to achieve something, I have to do it. So if there's any mistakes, I am the failure. I'm responsible. If I succeed, look how great I am. The pride, the grief or the guilt, all of that sort of stuff comes from the sense of having a sense of self. And it is almost impossible when everybody else sees life in the same way for us to actually to see things in a different way, which is one of the reasons why you do need someone who's killed themselves in this sense for them to then be an example, be a different way of looking at things so that you too can kill yourself as well. So the killing does sort of become contagious. And it's such an important thing to do. So why would it become contagious? Because a person who has killed themselves becomes a very interesting person to be around. I do, of course, remember my time with someone like an Ajahn Chah, just always really challenging you, because this was not an ordinary person, the sort of person I was used to. For me, if you were wise, it was because you learned a lot and you read many, many books. And there was a man who hadn't read much at all, only had 4 years at school, and was obviously, very clearly, very, very wise. Just the way just he ran things and did stuff, little things. I still remember one of the monks sort of was telling me that in those days in the monastery in the northeast of Thailand, we would stay up every night on the moon nights 4 times a week so we wouldn't sleep. And it was one of the Western monks always went back to have a rest. He wasn't into staying up all night. And so what Ajahn Chah did to make sure that he did stay up all night, after the talk on the moon night, he made an announcement, yes, now we're all going to stay up all night. You can do walking meditation outside, but you're not allowed to go back to your huts, except for this Western monk. He doesn't have to stay up. He can go to bed. And of course, that monk was so embarrassed that he stayed up all night. And even like a Thai monk just could suss out, could understand the conceit of Westerners. You don't want to stand out and be different. And so once he was given permission to go to bed, he couldn't go to bed at all. He had to stay up all night. Torture, he said. But, you know, that monk was far smarter than he was, Ajahn Chah. So those were little examples of some of the wisdom this monk really had, you know, which was, again, quite surprising. How come? So I had to start seeing things in a totally different way, even like wisdom and understanding, not coming from books, which is what I was conditioned to do, but coming from somewhere else. And where on earth did Ajahn Chah and these other great monks get all this amazing, amazing wisdom? And it also wasn't by thinking a lot. He wasn't a philosopher. You didn't see him just working things out logically through reason. In fact, a lot of the things he came up to were just totally unreasonable. They defied logic, but they worked. And those were some of the incredible things that, you know, what you thought would be the correct way of doing things, he just did it in a totally different way. And again, it worked really, really well. And when you understood those sorts of teachings, you understood that it wasn't coming from learning, it wasn't coming through thinking, it was coming from the stillness. I had learned enough about Buddhism, read enough books by that time, to know that all the time they were saying that wisdom comes from stillness. It seems to be that when the mind is really, really still, then you have an opportunity for seeing things in a new way. Not only that, but that little seed of seeing things in a new way comes about by having heard these teachings from somebody else. Well, they always say the words of another. First, someone has had to kill themselves, first of all. And you've come across them, saw them, And that's inspired you, that there's something going on here. And that gives you the inspiration, that when you are still, to allow other ways of seeing to emerge, to get outside of your cultural conditioning, to get outside of all of your knowledge, all of your wisdom, everything you've ever been taught. It is from that which I coined that little phrase, never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. And by learning, I mean everything you've ever heard, everything you've ever thought, everything you've ever been told by others is true. All of that, you have to put that aside. And never let it stand in the way of truth. Because a lot of what you've been heard is probably wrong, and that which you've heard which is right, you probably misunderstood it. See whippalazas, see distortions of perception and thoughts and eventually view. So this is where one cannot trust that. So one trusts in this beautiful silence to see things in a different way. In a way which you're encouraged to see, because when you are with someone like an Ajahn Chah, someone who has abandoned their sense of self, then you can actually get sort of inspired that this is a peaceful, happy person. Not a peaceful, happy person because they get what they want, because they live in comfort, because they've got servants looking after them all the time. These are peaceful, happy people because that's just what they like. And of course, you hang around such people for a while, and eventually you have this idea, whatever they have, I want too. Whatever they have, which makes them so peaceful, so wise, so in a sense of free, that's what I want as well. Because you all notice the frustration, the always constant craving, always trying to fix up problems, never allowing the mind to be peaceful, even though you don't have anything to do, we make things to do. And as I was saying in the sutta class last Saturday, we know we want to want. We want to want something. We want a problem. We want to do things. We just know the wanting of wanting, the addiction to it, the necessity to always have something to occupy our minds. And that is the totally feeling ill at ease that if we got nothing to do, feeling bored, feeling there's something wrong, feeling there's a hole which has to be filled up rather than just letting the hole be. It's so difficult for us to do that. And of course the reason is because one still has the illusion of a self. Whenever there is a self, there'll always be some wanting, some trying to do things. That's the difficulty. As long as there is a sense of self, one will be wanting, one will be restless. That's where it all comes from. That's what a sense of self does. It wants, it does, it craves, it makes problems. And because it's wanting and making problems and thinking and planning, that's why one can't have enough stillness to find that there's no sense of self there to begin with. It's a catch-22 situation. So because there's an illusion of a self, we can never be still enough to catch it and to see it. Because it's a self, that illusion, that way of looking at things, which always keeps us busy. So, we do see other people who seem to have got some wisdom, some peace, some happiness, or inspiring. And because we want to emulate some of that, it is a wanting. But it seems to be a wanting which stops all wanting. We try to emulate them. And to emulate them, we just try this beautiful path of stillness, of not wanting. It's a tough thing to do, because there is something inside of us always pushing us, always demanding that we do something, we think something. It's so difficult when you're getting into some deep meditation. Things are going well, but there's always something which tends to disturb you. Always just at the last moment interfering with a nimitta, or even interfering with the breath. You can't just let it just proceed on. There's always something comes in and spoils it all the time. What is that? That is your sense of self. You always want to do it. That's why it's just so hard to actually get some stillness. It's so hard to leave things alone. I used to see that when I was a layperson. You know, people would, you'd be cooking something. And someone would come, oh, no, that's not how to do it. This is how you do it. And they'd sort of butt in and tell me how to do it. Later on, when I was a young monk, I was meditating. I was doing walking meditation. I always remember this. Walking meditation, we had a visiting monk who had never did many meditation in his life, but studied meditating. He did exams on meditation. And so he came up and told me that that's not how to meditate. You should meditate this way. It was really funny. He had a clue what he was talking about, but he studied it. That's what it said in Visuddhimagga. He never actually done anything. But you can see there that why did he want to get involved? It's always a sense of self, always wanting to interfere with what you're doing. Why can't we just let other people do it? That's why that sometimes as a senior monk, or as a senior nun, you have to let all the juniors do the job, knowing you can do it much better, knowing they're going to make a big mess. Why? It's because you need to show them how to kill yourself. Show them. You just let them do it and make a mess of it. Doesn't matter, but you're not going to interfere and you're not going to allow other people to interfere. You're not going to get this sense of self which always interferes with everything. Can never leave anything alone. I can do it better than you can. Yeah, a lot of the time I can do it better than you can, but that's not the point. It's not the point to do it better. It's learning how to not do it better. And I can not do it better than many of you. Not doing it, okay? Not doing it. We're not into doing stuff in this monastery. We're into learning how to not do stuff. To be peaceful, to let it go, to let it be. Leave it alone. Don't interfere. Don't get involved. Don't get entangled with the world. And if you know what we're talking about there, what you're doing is you're actually resisting, restraining this sense of self. You are allowing this sense of self to have not much to do. And it just can't work, it can't plan, it can't do projects. And this sense of self, eventually, if you carry on like this, your sense of self gets like Venerable Upasama. Gets malnourished. I'm not going to let you forget this. Your sense of self gets malnourished. Because what nourishes a sense of self? It's doing stuff. Being someone. Sort of being in charge and seeing the results of all your hard work. And just, yeah, I built that wall. Yeah, just, you know, I wrote that book. Yeah. And all of that sort of stuff, you know, it just nourishes the sense of self and the sense of ego. And I was actually mentioning just in that birthday party last week, I have a really interesting life. You know, I had that birthday party on the Hyatt, all these people, including Ajahn Pamali and Ajahn and Venerable Hasapanya, were going up there just saying what a wonderful monk I was. Now, usually you have to wait till your funeral to hear all these nice words about you. You should have recorded all of that, Ajahn Pamali and Hasapanya, so when I do die, you've already got your eulogy already written. Save a lot of time. And anyway, 65, it's getting close. So, but anyway, when people say such wonderful things of you, now how do you react to that? It's just words. It doesn't mean anything. Because remember, just I said it there, that years and years and years ago, there was an event in my life which really challenged me and just had to really check myself. It was one of the first times, must be about 10 years ago now, I gave a very, very big talk. It was in Singapore, in Suntec City, There's about 3,000, 4,000 people sitting there. And when I saw all those people had just come just to listen to me, there was no supporting act. It was just Ajahn Brahm sitting there in front of all these people, all of them listening to your every word. First of all, was the red flag of danger come up. You know, this is, you can get so conceited, you know, in a situation like this. So many people giving you attention. So many people spending their evening just to come and listen to you. And then, just I realized, and the what I made use of to make sure that I didn't get into conceit, and something which I will share with you so you can do the same, is to realize that that person who was going to give that talk that evening was not Ajahn Brahm, that I was the product of my teacher. It was Ajahn Chah. It was Ajahn Chah giving that talk. It was Ajahn Chah who had killed himself and inspired me to kill myself. So the serial killing just continued, one after another. Because if that was any sense of self in there, I'd have been dead by now. Dead as a monk, hopeless, useless. You can't just give such huge, big talks with so many people listening to you if you have any ego. It just will not work. People will see right through it. It's not the talk, the subject. It's the emptiness from where it's coming from. That is really what makes it work. So this is how that you learn to empty out that sort of sense of who you are and not interfere with it. You're just basically going with the flow. Sometimes I say this as a joke, but it is so true. Many of the things I say as a joke are actually just dumber. That whenever I go overseas, even here, I don't decide to give a talk. You know, it's a Wednesday or day Thursday, so you just go and give a talk. You don't even think about it. When go overseas, so you know, Victor is here from the BGF. Victor says, "Okay, give a talk." So I just go and give a talk. He said, "Finish now," so I get down and finish. So totally out of control, especially you know, for those of you who know in Singapore, Angie. She says, "Get up." I just get up. Go down. I go down. Sometimes she said, "Time." She says, "Okay, finish off." I don't control anything. Just do what I'm told. That's what I do. Even here in this monastery, just do what I have to. That's all I do. So what we're doing there is actually looking at life from a different perspective, a different angle. An angle of just seeing everything from a sense of like an emptiness. Not a me, not a self. I'm not trying to get anywhere, not trying to do anything, not trying to achieve anything. Certainly not trying to be anybody. That is just so awful to if you're trying to be somebody. That's why I just mess around. Mess around, just let my robes fall off. Is that how a monk is supposed to be? I don't know, that's your problem. That's what happens. Scratching my nose during the talk. I don't care if people catch that on camera. I had this wonderful way of overcoming all fear of giving talks. And when I started on this, I thought, well, okay, it doesn't matter. If I give really awful talks, and everybody feels they're so stupid, and no one gets inspired at all, and everybody thinks that that's just so boring, that would be so sweet. Then I will never have to give a talk ever again. Whoopee. I really thought that. I said, but if people like it, that's fine. Then you know, people get inspired. Whoopee. Either way, I've got nothing to lose, nothing to gain. Which means you just do your job without even worrying about results or how it goes, good or bad, who knows. So this is the way that when sense of self can vanish. It's amazing just how you can do things without interfering. Interfering with this flow of life, how you can get sick without interfering. Sickness is just sickness, just let it go. You're going to die one day anyway, so might as well get it over and done with. That's how I feel. So there's no fear at all. There's no interfering. Because all fear comes from the sense of a self and owning things. I've often wondered why fear comes up at all in your life. There's always the fear of failure if you have to give a talk. fear of, I always remember one of the first times I went on TV. I remember this because Ajahn Brahmadi was there. You remember? That was, I thought I was giving the sermon, that's right, at St. George's Cathedral at that time. Apparently, according to the Dean, John Shepherd, it was the first time ever in Christianity a non-Christian had given the sermon at a Eucharist in 2,000 years. That was really cool. So, I think it was Akagata, who knows everybody. He knew somebody who worked in Channel 7 or Channel 9 or somewhere, so they got me to the studio to actually to do an interview for the news. And there you were in the studio. But, you know, first time I've been in a studio in Australia, so they insisted I had makeup. And so, yeah, okay, makeup. I'm a man, okay. Okay, you know, you ladies don't know what it feels like for a man to have makeup with Ajahn Brahmadi looking at you and putting faces. Really mean. That was good fun, though. I just enjoy it, having fun there. But anyhow, but there you go. So what? You know, it's just what you have to do. You don't interfere with it. You don't sort of make a big deal of it one way or the other. That means you can be much more relaxed, much more fun, and that, you know, showing, demonstrating non-self becomes quite inspiring for others. And it actually becomes something which can actually improve their faith and say, I want to be like that. I want to be able to just do stuff without worrying about it, without having any fear. Because all the fear is about losing your reputation. When you haven't got a reputation, you know, actually I don't have a reputation. Other people own my reputation, I don't. You know, other people think, you know, that Ajahn Chah is like this or Ajahn Brahm is like that. Ajahn Chah never had a reputation, he owned nothing. It was only other people's idea of who he was. You know, there's nothing, nobody there. So when you don't own anything, you've got nothing to lose. And all fear comes from you're about to lose something. You're afraid of losing it. It's being taken away from you. Fear always comes with you letting go a piece of yourself. That is one of the reasons why when you do become a monk, it's quite scary being a monk. It means, you know, all these things you could do as a lay person, you can't do anymore. You know, it's like you're losing your freedoms, who you are. You can't just go to your favourite clubs or bars or soccer anymore. You know, you're not a Liverpool supporter anymore. You never go. You know, part of who you are is disappearing. And of course that's scary. And you're losing control. You know what it's like when you first come here. You know, you always try and get your areas of control and, you know, your little empires within the empire. And after a while, you just let it all go and you just don't do anything. You just do what you're told. You know, it's much easier to do what you're told than actually make decisions for yourself. I mean that. And I'm not talking in a bad way, like I'm some sort of Kim Jong-un. Just do what you're told, otherwise you get executed. But it's just more pleasant. You don't have to make decisions. Just do what's needed. Somebody else tells you, or life tells you what to do. You just do it. Because that means you don't have to worry too much about thinking. And all that thinking, planning, controlling, all comes from the sense of self. So little by little, you are weakening and killing. You are taking away the fuel of the sense of self, its nutriment, and you're becoming more and more malnourished, your sense of self. You're not feeding it. And that's one of the things in monastic life which you don't tend to get out there in the world. Out there in the world, everyone's telling you to be special, to stand out from the crowd, to achieve, to be the best, to do things differently. You know, don't wear the same sort of clothes that everyone else wears. Now be individual, stand out. But here in monasteries, we all look the same. Same robes every day, the same haircut every day. We can't dye our hair, you know, like you used to do before, Akalika. You know, you can't dye anything. Except your rose, but it's all the same colour, isn't it? So it's amazing just how we can't stand out as monks and nuns. So it's all letting go of our individuality so that we can vanish more and more and more. And as we lessen all of this stuff which we do eventually find that we feel more free. Freedom from the sense of me, the sense of self. It's such a big burden having to live up to other people's expectations. Oh, it's that nice little story, it's one of my favourite ones. And I don't care if you don't like this story because I don't care at all. That was a story, and it just happened just a few metres outside of this hall. Busy working in those days, which I used to really work, and if you think I look a bit sloppy now, oh, you should have seen me this day. I've been busy mixing up cement. Ajahn Bamadi knows a cement mixer, the very old one. You shouldn't have got rid of that. You should have kept it and auctioned it off. That would have been worth a lot of money. That was my cement mixer. I brought that and I built much of this monastery with that cement mixer. And anyway, I knew how to use it. And it was absolutely true. I'm not exaggerating. Other people would try and get it working, just in a petrol-driven one. They pulling it didn't work. I said, leave it alone. I did it because I knew it. It was my friend. We worked together for such a long time. I don't know what it is, but sometimes you can actually get a connection with a machine and it works. And it always worked for me. It's really well behaved. Other people know, because you didn't know, you didn't have the sort of the emotional connection with my cement mixer. So I was busy mixing it all up and mixing cement and stuff, having a great time. Getting really dirty, not just on my robes, but just, you know, over my face and everywhere, splodges of grey. Great. Love that sort of stuff. But then, as I was walking to my room to take the shower, this Sri Lankan lady came. It's a very good simile. It was actually pretty accurate because she was wearing so many of those bangles. Well, I thought it was an ice cream truck come. Tingle, 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 tingle. That's what it sounded like, honestly. And when she came closer, you know, first time to this monastery, she asked, where's Ajahn Brahm? Is Ajahn Brahm here? Because I wasn't going to let on that, you know, she was standing right in front of him. I just told her, if you go to the dining room. He'd probably be down there in about 10 or 15 minutes. Oh, thank you. And I can shower pretty quickly. Monks, losing up all the hot water in this place. You should learn how to shower very quickly because, you know, it can be to your advantage in situations like I found myself in, how to shower pretty quickly and get changed. And I appeared in the dining room, you know, just maybe 10 or 15 minutes before lunch. And there she was waiting for me. She said, oh, Ajahn Brahm, it was such an honour to meet you. Oh, first of all, I think she said I'm from Sri Lanka. Very happy to meet you. And then asked some Dhamma questions, and then she was very impressed. She said, oh, you're a very good monk. You've got a beautiful monastery, except for one thing, she said. I always remember this. Except for one thing. I said, what's that, madam? He said, on the way here, I met one of your monks, and he was very badly dressed. That's very inappropriate that monks should be so badly dressed in your monastery. And she never realized for a moment it was me. She didn't know. So I was just playing along with her. I said, okay, very good, madam. I'll talk to him later on. Which I did. I do talk to myself. I wasn't lying to her. It's crazy. Which one was Ajahn Brahm? Whichever one she wanted, that's all. And that's marvellous. When you don't have a sense of self, you can play around and have much more fun, for goodness sakes. You're not afraid. People criticise you. Yeah, I was sloppy. So that was a sloppy Ajahn Brahm to be criticised. and then I was a bit better dressed. Maybe not so better dressed, but much better dressed. Even I must have this reputation now, because when I went to the Buddha Light International, the Fo Kwang Shan group, when I went to their Buddha's birthday, was it the last time? Oh no, it wasn't the Buddha's birthday, it was the opening of, I think, Dharmasara Monastery, when Mike Nahan came. And when he gave his speech, he said, well, I was wondering, I'm coming to an opening of a Buddhist monastery, you know, how well should I dress? But I thought, well, Ajahn Brahm's going to be here, so casual. Yeah. He said, very casual. Well, that's, you know, who cares? It's just a sense of self. But anyway, when you start to lose reputation and people start to criticize you, put you down, why do you get upset? Why do you get afraid? It's because they're pointing out you've still got a sense of self in there somewhere. Which one is the right you? The one which gets criticized, the one which gets blamed. So when you understand it's killing the sense of self, you've got no one in there. Who the heck are people praising or blaming? There's no one in there. You become just absolutely zero target. They shoot you and it goes right through. There's nothing to stop it. Which means that you can just have fun in your monastic life. And that becomes very attractive. Which means other people get sort of pulled into where you are at. That you've killed yourself and you kill other people. Their sense of self just starts to disappear. And with it, all this fear. And so many people, it's one of the difficulties in monastic life, for men and women, trying so hard to be a perfect nun. Maybe not a perfect nun, but to be a good nun. And the more you're trying hard to be a good nun, especially a perfect nun, the more of a sense of solid self you develop. Which means that, you know, you can't, you're always stiff, tight, never relaxed. You try and meditate and it's just, again, too much tightness inside of you. Always trying to be perfect. Or at least trying to be good. When you try to be good, you end up being bad. So stop trying. Just relax. Just let be. There's nobody in here, so who needs to be perfect? So when you learn how to let go of the sense of self, and all of the things which belong to a sense of self start to vanish too. All these achievements, praise, being well regarded, being popular. Being popular sucks. If I had my time again, I'd try to be unpopular. Then I could have more time by myself in my cave. Well, you know, you can't change things, that's just who you are. So, in the end, you learn how to just to be, rather than trying to change. Because it's weird, when you say, I'm just going to be, you actually disappear. You vanish. The statement is, oh, just to be. Because you don't do things, your sense of being diminishes and diminishes and diminishes. It fades away. And this is what happens. If you don't strive, if you don't try and improve, if you don't try and plan and make and grow, if you don't try and do those things, your sense of self tends to, again, get malnourished. So all those doing and planning and struggling and striving and all your goals, that is what actually feeds your sense of self. And when you stop all of that, your sense of self just again gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And then it just disappears for a little while. It doesn't just explode away. It vanishes and comes back still pretty weak and vanishes again. That's what's called the deep meditations. Temporarily vanishing and coming back again. It's just like Swiss cheese with holes in it. That's your existence. Simply because there's nothing much left there. And when it does come back, it's not all that solid. And then it can vanish pretty quickly. Simply because if there's no sense of self, or a very diminished sense of self, if that's been mostly killed or on its last legs, about to die, if it's in the ICU, on life support, your sense of self, it means that you can flip out in and out of this world so easily. You're just sitting there and things vanish. Because there's no sense of self, you don't do things. That's what the sense of self does. It does stuff. So when it gets very weak, it does less. When it starts to vanish, it does even less. That is called stillness. Contentment, because there's no wanting. The wanting comes from the sense of self. When the sense of self starts to disappear, so does the wanting. Stillness at last. This answers the question, how can you stop all this wanting? That's wanting to stop wanting. And it just goes round in a circle. How you overcome wanting, how you let go. Always wisdom, power. There's nobody in here anyway. There's nothing to attain. There's nothing, no goals. You've done goals so long, you've done goals. Enough of goals. And just be and vanish and disappear. And when that happens, stillness is all that's left. I know that just this morning over in Jhana Grove, people say, if I do that, I'll fall asleep. Great. At least something's vanishing. But I've got to attain something. I've come all this way. Stop it. Because the point is, and I know this well, when you're tired, you get dull. But after a while, the dullness, if you're really still, you're doing it properly, you're not getting negative towards the dullness and trying to get rid of it, because that you are vanishing. Your goals, possessions, judging your meditation, who you think you are and how good or how bad you are, all that is sense of self again. After a while, when that disappears, so does everything. You get so still. And the stillness is bliss. It's a bliss of freedom. Freedom from having to do stuff, having to be somebody, having to achieve. Do you remember what it was like when you were a kid at school? You could enjoy yourself playing around and somebody said, no, you've got to pass an exam. You've got a career, you've got to achieve things, you've got to do stuff. You've got to be somebody. What do you want to be when you grow up? Did anyone ever say, when people used to ask you that question, I want to be a nobody? They put you into the school psychologist or psychiatrist if you say things like that. No, I want to be a train driver, or I want to be an astronaut. That's what they, when I was a kid. But all that sort of stuff is absolutely ridiculous and stupid. So instead, we learn how to not to want anything. And then your sense of self vanishes, disappears. And that dullness tends to just evaporate into bliss, freedom. Freedom from what? Freedom from wanting stuff, from having to achieve stuff, having to get stuff. Haven't you had enough of that in your life? All these things which you had to achieve, pass this exam, get that qualification, you get a BA and then you get an MA and then you get a PhD and then you get a PhD doubled, cubed or whatever it is, with honours and distinctions and then another. And it's endless, absolutely endless. And what are you achieving? What are you getting? That's why when I saw all these people, that was an eye-opener for me. I never really appreciated it until I saw someone who killed themselves, like an Ajahn Chah. These Nobel Prize winners. The master of the college, he used to have dinner with him every now and again because I was a scholar. He was a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry. Don't know what he actually did, but you know, he got a Nobel Prize. And he was just a pain in the neck. I shouldn't say that, but there he was. And he was an example of a wise, happy person. So, that, you know, you go and see Ajahn Chah, he didn't have a Nobel Prize in anything. But, you know, he was just so happy. So it's those sorts of people, they draw you in, this other way of living a life. Killing yourself encourages other people to do the same. Because it rocks. It's sweet. It's beautiful. It's freedom. Freedom from this constant pressure to do something, achieve something, get rid of stuff. Because there's a constant pressure on you, always called life. And eventually you learn how to let go of that pressure. So you don't have to do anything, be anybody, go anywhere. That force vanishes. Oh, what bliss. That's why I called it the freedom from desire. Not the freedom of desire, but the freedom from desire. The freedom from wanting. Contentment. Real contentment. Sit there, you don't want anything in the whole world. Really, honestly. You're just totally content. Not a want coming up in the mind. And with it, all of your ideas of a self out the window, gone, vanish. There can't be a self without wanting. When there's no wanting, your illusion of self, you've got a window to see there's nothing there. And when there's nothing there, you have the opportunity to break through and see the Dhamma. Just five khandhas. So what do you want? Just five khandhas doing their stuff. You don't sort of control them. You don't try and manipulate them. You just leave them alone. Freedom from desire. Freedom from wanting. Freedom from this thing which keeps you moving. And a little while, if you know you've done the right thing, that's freedom from wanting, really contentment, because a contentment is not stable, never is. Contentment just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It just builds until it explodes in the jhanas. That's what happens. So still, nothing moves. Old Ajahn Chah's getting up his hand and waving it in front of me and saying, this is the wind making the leaf move. If the wind stopped, the leaf would become perfectly still. If you didn't want anything, you had freedom from desires, your mind would get more and more and more still. And the more still it gets, the more things vanish, and the closer you get to the jhanas, you enter the jhanas, taste of freedom. Freedom from desire, freedom from the sense of self. It's one of the reasons why people get those jhanas and they think it's enlightenment, think it's the original mind, think it's just God. You get in those, you understand why people make those mistakes. But still, it's pretty neat anyway. Because things have vanished. Your sense of self has gone, and with it, wanting. That's why there are still stable, peaceful states where you can sit for hours. There's no wanting. And afterwards, you get an idea what it's like to have no self. Your whole perception has changed. You have the opportunity to see things in a different worldview, a different culture, the indigenous Buddhist culture, indigenous to all the Buddhas and the Arahats and the Aryans, their way of seeing things. Totally different to that of the world. So, kill yourself first, then go around killing others. And then, like a well-destroyed self, you will lure all these other sentient beings to go with you into the place where there's no more selves. Enlightenment, freedom. At last. That's the talk this evening.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu.